This is Chris McGregor with information on how you can help Discerning Hearts continue our mission during our summer appeal. No doubt this has been a very challenging year, but because of the generosity of so many of our donors, it's also been a year of blessing. But to make it to the end of the year, we do need your help. We are funded 100% by those touched by the work of Discerning Hearts. So between now and August 22nd, if you can help with a donation or with your prayers, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate by clicking on the link found on the discerninghearts.com website or inside the Discerning Hearts free app. Thank you, and God bless from all of us at Discerning Hearts.
Welcome to the Formed Book Club, brought to you by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. On the program today, Ignatius Press founder and editor, Jesuit Father Joseph Fessio, Ignatius Press editor Vivian Doudreau, and best-selling author and editor Joseph Pierce. Join the program as they discuss Cardinal Robert Seurat's book, The Day Is Now Far Spent.
So welcome, everyone, to the Formed Book Club again. You can't see Joseph scratching his ear yet, but I'm going to put him on the screen so if he does it again, we'll all notice it. So this book is taking us many sessions to go through. Vivian, you mentioned before the session here that there's some repetition, so we'll try and not repeat the things that are already we've already talked about. But he does cover such a broad, you know, spectrum of contemporary problems in the church and in the world, and he has such interesting comments on it, and quite a few little phrases that I think ought to stand for a long time. Right now, we are in the third part of this book. There's three parts of it. The day is now far spent. The book is now far spent, but not far enough. Part one was the spiritual and religious collapse, especially the crisis of the faith and the priesthood. Part two was man belittled with hatred of man, hatred of life. And now we're in part three, which is the longest part, the fall of truth, moral decadence, and bad political habits. We are on chapter 11, which is about halfway through this part three. So let's begin. It's called Ruthless Enemies. And I have a quote I want to discuss on the very first page of the chapter, page 241. But if anybody has something you want to say prior to the first half of that paragraph, you may continue.
I actually wanted to comment on Nicholas Diaz's question.
Okay.
No, I'm joking.
All right.
Off you go.
So he's talking about Westerners here. And he says, well, here's a pack sins. Despite worrisome symptoms, they, that is Westerners, refuse to call themselves into question. Let us take the example of, here he goes on, the arts, architecture, poetry, painting, or music. Can anyone fail to note the terrible regression? Beauty disappears from the horizon. Ugliness is set up as an unsurpassable norm. I'm glad a black man from Africa can speak out so clearly about something that I've thought, but you can't say it. You can't say the art is ugly. You can't say the architect is ugly. You can't say the music is terrible. You're not supposed to say that. But, you know, he's like from another planet. He's coming in here. Well, gosh, I just got here, folks, and what are you doing? So I think he nails it.
It reminds me of a time I was at the art museum in San Francisco with my children, and they had a special program for the children, and they had selected certain paintings for the children to look at. And the docent asked the children, so what do you think of this painting? And one of the children said, that's ugly, just like that, just like a little child would do, right? And she immediately, oh, you mustn't say that. You can't say that. That's just your subjective experience and blah, blah, blah. And of course, already the kid doesn't know what the lady's talking about or cares. It was pretty funny.
I remember way back into 1995, it was one of your children. It was Thomas, your oldest son, And at that time, they were planning some new churches in Rome with different architects, you know. And her son Thomas was there. How old was he in 1995? Tell me in a minute. Anyway, do the calculation while I'm talking here. So there was an article that showed these artists' conceptions of these new churches. And they were horrible, modernistic. And I showed little Thomas. I says, "What do you think about these?" He said, "Well, they don't like churches to me. They don't look like churches. I mean, out of the mouths of babes."
That's right. That's right.
But on the other side, in the next page, he talks about his being an African and Africa being invaded by the colonialism of the West. What does he say? Top of the page, 242. "In my own life in Africa, I was able to appreciate the finest fruits of Western colonization." Get that. The finest fruits of Western colonization. "The cultural, moral, and religious values that the French gave to my country were a great treasure. The colonists came with rich, living, ancestral traditions ennobled by Christianity. Their conscience of the dignity and rights of man and of human values were emancipating. French gave me an extraordinary language, très bien, c'est le français, n'est-ce pas? The missionaries from that country brought me the true God." Last sentence here. "I am not afraid to say that I am the child of a constructive colonization." Thank God he's grateful for that.
Yes, and that puts into perspective his sometimes very harsh critique of the West. And, you know, he's not saying Western civilization, as it had been handed down for some time, is what he's criticizing. It's the modern renunciation of it and relativization of everything. And yes, a child can't say something is ugly and we can't say something is beautiful, because this all requires some kind of norm or standard of and what he's denouncing is that the West has is denying itself. And that's an important thing to remember when you read his very harsh critiques sometimes of the West.
Right, and I think that's exactly right, that you see he appreciates the great contribution the West has made in history and to his country. But he who has more freshly received these gifts and can compare them with what his life was before and what his country's life was before, he's very grateful. But now he sees that we are wasting our patrimony.
We're throwing it away.
We're throwing it away.
Yeah. I mean, although this is becoming a recurring motif of the dialectic in these book clubs, we do need to distinguish between the Cartesianism of the Enlightenment that was embryonic relativism, because quite clearly, you know, that Cardinal Suar, thanks be to God, can differentiate between the West of Christendom and the West of the so-called Enlightenment that led to relativism. And he knows the difference between the two, because if you lump them all in together, and that's the problem, you know, we lump them all in together and I think the West somehow is something which was Christian and then has outgrown it as part of our progress. So if we don't make that distinction, then we're going to confuse people.
And the Enlightenment had different effects and consequences in different parts of Europe and here as well. You think you compare the French Revolution with the English Revolution.
Or the Scottish Enlightenment thinkers to the French Enlightenment thinkers. Very different kinds of men with very different moral compasses.
Right. But also, I mean, he's praising the French colonists because he's French-speaking. So even post-Enlightenment, he recognized that there were some positive values to that Enlightenment, even in France, but that they have been exaggerated, so to speak, and made to an extreme. I mean, rationalism. And Benedict, too, was also Benedict XVI, but also Benedict II, also has said this, and it was a theme of his, that the Enlightenment is not all bad.
That's right.
But it's not all good either.
That's right.
And that's where you're saying, Joseph.
The ratio which preceded the Enlightenment and rationalism, which was a fruit of it. You know, I mean, we I think we just need to not even using the name Enlightenment assumes that there was something that was dark prior to it. And of course, there's lots of been dark prior to it. There's lots of been dark since it. The darkness is evil in its sin. And the thing which is the light is the good, the true, and the beautiful. And reason certainly existed prior to the Enlightenment, whether it's the Scottish manifestation, the English manifestation, or the French manifestation, or the German manifestation.
Right, but they were responding to, you know, these systems of thought can get ossified and need to be broken open every now and then. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But you're absolutely right. No, go on. Or actually, Joseph, does he have a quote? Do you have a quote?
My next one is on 247, so I got a lot.
I do actually. I want to just refer to the discussion in the bottom half of 242 and then down to the middle of 243 without quoting too much of it. He's talking about globalization, and he talks about that globalization tends to make humanity uniform. One-size-fits-all culture. Globalization means cutting man off from his roots, from his religion, from his culture, history, customs, and ancestors. He becomes stateless, without a country, without a land. He is at home everywhere and nowhere. And then on the next page, just as a conclusion of this, globalization insidiously seeks to cut young people off from these roots. And I think that's the whole point, is that we need that continuum, which is the experience of humanity through the centuries. And that's something which is lost, because globalism is about a new order, a new power, a new colonialism, and turning its back on the past to something which is self-evidently inferior to the present. That sort of insidious progressivism which drives globalization, or drives globalism. Globalization is somewhat different.
And at the, you know, at the root of this drive to eliminate differences, cultural differences, religious differences, and so on.
Sexual differences is
an assumption that somehow the differences in and of themselves are the source of human conflict.
But the amazing thing is that on this other hand, they're saying diversity, diversity, diversity.
I know.
They want diversity in a one planet society, you know. I don't get it.
So somehow there has to be both a celebration of differences, which he even says God created a pluralistic world. He says that on page 242.
Yeah, and I mean, the point is, I mean, I've said this before here, and it's not just Conor Swan, perhaps it gets repetitive here, but, you know, Solzhenitsyn talking about the nations of Europe being a great garden with different flowers, and we don't just want a monoculture wheat field, Monsanto wheat field for that matter, right. Globally.
Right, right.
Well, he says that specifically, the bottom of issue 42, being in his paragraph there, God wanted to place his creature in a garden, I mean, Eden, right? In a country, on a continent, nations are large families. So, you know, what is it? It takes a village to make, what is that famous
saying? It takes a village to raise a child, which was a slogan of Hillary Clinton. And it's true if the words mean what they say. But what she means by village, of course, is the government, right? If what right. you mean is a child is born into a family,
right.
There's grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles and cousins, and then villages are actually, as he says, extended families. And so it takes more than one person to raise a child well. But unfortunately, when this statement is used by some people, what they really mean is that the government needs to raise your child.
Right.
So,
agreed.
Which we don't want. Thank you very much.
I don't want that.
No.
Of course, it's too late for me. But anyway, I have enough altruism to want to have your children, grandchildren be have all the blessings that I've had, you know. Anything before 247?
244.
Okay.
First sentence, final paragraph of that page. Everything must be done so that people can remain in the countries that saw their birth. In other words, that the refugee crisis or the migration crisis is something that the best solution to it, ideally, would be to solve the problems that are causing people to have to leave on the ground locally. That's the ideal solution, and that would be the correct approach to try to solve these problems. Obviously, if they can't be solved, then the solution has to be to get people out. But that should not be the default. The default should be the other way around. Well, why are people having to leave this region? What's the problem? How can we put the problem right at grassroots level where they are locally so that we don't have to have this migration issue, which is causing such an upheaval culturally and politically to Europe, and not just Europe, of course.
Well, I'll buy you a one-way ticket to England if you'll buy me a one-way ticket to Italy.
Well, I think
you get a better deal.
Yeah. I think the critical word in the sentence is can remain.
Right.
In other words, when people are taking flight because of dire circumstances, war and famine, and, you know, many of those people would not be leaving their homes if it weren't for this disaster, right?
Right, I agree with you completely that the word can is crucial. You can't say must, because that requires regimentation and totalitarianism and all those things nobody wants. But we do have to differentiate between those who are genuinely refugees and those who are economic migrants. And once you have a flow of people coming in and there's no will to stop them, then for every one refugee, there's a dozen migrants. And all of a sudden, you have a problem which is on a scale that is going to cause all sorts of problems where they end up. In other words, they're not going to come to the utopia they think they're coming to. They're going to come to a place which is becoming worse because of the migration problem that they're a part of.
We'll return to the Foreign Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce in just a moment. Did you know that Discerning Hearts has a free app in which you can find all your favorite Discerning Hearts programming? Father Timothy Gallagher, Dr. Anthony Lillis, Deacon James Keating, Mike Aquilina, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, and so many more are found on the Discerning Hearts free app. Did you also know that you can stream Discerning Hearts programming on numerous streaming platforms such as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and so many more? And did you know that Discerning Hearts also has the YouTube page? Be sure to check out all these different places where you can find Discerning Hearts. A prayer of St. Ignatius of Loyola.
Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will, all that I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me. Amen.
Hello, my name is Deacon Omar Gutierrez, and I want to ask you to support Discerning Hearts in a special way. We, Chris McGregor, the board, and I all know that not everyone listening can help financially. We know we have listeners from all parts of the world, and we have made a commitment since the beginning to make the truths shared through Discerning Hearts totally free. So while you may not be able to contribute financially, what you can do is certainly pray, but also give us positive reviews on whatever platform you use to listen to us. If it's iTunes, Android, Stitcher, or Spotify, however it is that you get these podcasts, or if you're on YouTube and you like our videos, please give us a good rating and write a review. The more good ratings and reviews we get, the higher our profile, and the more listeners will discover us, listeners who may have the means to contribute in the future. Please consider rating us and writing a positive review today.
We now return to the Formed Book Club with Father Joseph Fezzio, Vivian Doudreau, and Joseph Pierce.
But I understand, I mean, there's no place in the world more beautiful than California. So I can see why they want to come here. Although they're leaving now because it's so high. But that's okay.
Domestically, more people are leaving the state than entering it.
Good riddance.
But what do you mean good riddance.
More space.
Oh. Okay. But in any case, the point is people move around. That's part of just the natural flow. I mean, since the beginning of time.
An acceleration of something which has always been around is not necessarily a good thing. In other words, there's always been movement, and there's always been movement, I feel like, on a human scale. If things become accelerated to such a degree that it's no longer on a human scale, that it becomes dehumanized and inhumane, then there's a problem. And right. We have to sort that problem out, because there's this natural movement, which is, you know, thanks be to God. And you might find a country like the United States, which is huge with very few people living on it. The indigenous population might disagree with this, but there is lots of room for people to move here, right? But that's not necessarily the case in other circumstances at other times.
Right. You know? Yes. There's lots of circumstances that make a difference in how we look at this situation and the people in this situation.
And even though God places in a garden of paradise, a garden of Eden, we're not going to reconstitute after the fall the Edenic paradise here.
No.
And therefore, no particular solution is ever going to be satisfactory to solve all the problems. I would say one thing I've experienced, which I do appreciate, but it can't be for everybody. I know several very large families, 6, 7, 8, 10 children, that they've all decided to live in the same area, and the children marry somewhere in that area, they live, and then Sundays are a big gathering of the whole family, you know, the extended family. It's a beautiful thing, but it's not for everybody.
No. Abraham Lincoln's father, as soon as he saw the smokestack coming from a nearby settler's house, he would tell his family, time to move. I mean, some people just are on the go. And
yeah, I agree, but these days, how many people are moving homes and moving their families, not because they want to, but because of economic necessity? Now, that's not just true of economic migrants in the Middle East or Mexico. It's true of people working for global corporations in the United States that are just told by their company, sorry, you have to move from Atlanta to Houston. And if you move your family, that's it. There's no question about it. And whether they want to move or not is irrelevant, because they don't move, they're out, jobless.
Yeah, I would even like it if the Major League Baseball teams and the National Football League would actually have players from that region. I mean, it would end up having a little more parity in the league if they did that. But
I think even more disruptive is when the whole team picks up and leaves.
Well,
you know, I mean, look at the emotional trauma to some people when their team that I've identified with and their fan base, and they pick up and move to another city because they got a better, sweeter deal.
Then,
I know a lot of people.
And then you get such real anomalies as the Utah Jazz, because they started in New Orleans, of course. The New Orleans Jazz, that made sense. But the Utah Jazz?
Yeah, it's a bit of an oxymoron.
Give me a break.
Anyway,
anything before 247?
No.
Vivian?
No.
Well, I think I might have quoted this last time, but I just want to say it again, middle of 247. I respect the family policy of Russia more than that of Great Britain, Canada, or France. So that's a pretty bold thing to say. Yeah, you can say Putin's a thug, and, you know, it's still totalitarian, it's a one-party state, but... And maybe the reasons are bad for it. You know, they're trying to get more people because they run out of people. They make a lot of space. But the fact is, they promote the family there.
Yes, we talked about this at length last time.
All right.
There's demographic implosion, obviously, and that includes Russia and Hungary. And I do think the proactive policies being taken there are good. And we have to hope they're successful and indeed emulated.
But I don't think it's a good thing to try and encourage families to have children by paying them more money, you know. But there should be a kind of tax break for families who they've got one person working, hopefully, not necessarily two, and they're raising citizens for the country. They should get a break, because they are doing more economic for the country than someone who's just one person in a factory or even in management, something like that. So, it's one of those things where we're not in a perfect world. But I do think we should have tax policies which encourage, which don't discourage people from having a normal family. That's the thing, you know.
Right, that's the thing. Don't have disincentives.
All right, well, that's chapter 11. Anything more in chapter 11? We're now going to go to chapter 12. And I have no underlined passages, not because there aren't worthy passages there. It's just that it's like a feast where you're getting all kinds of rich food. After a while, you say, you know, just give me a glass of water, will you? So chapter 12 is the deception seductions of supposedly emancipated life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have something at the top of page 250. It's a very short chapter, and that's all I have.
Okay.
Suffering, whether interior or physical, no longer has a legitimate place in the modern world. It is necessary to hide the handicapped, forget the sick, and warehouse the elderly. Old age is no fun. Therefore, it must be hidden behind the gloomy walls of retirement homes. Again, another perfect example of the culture of death. Basically, if we won't accept suffering, we have to first of all hide it. But that also, one step removed from that, is to actually get rid of those who are suffering, because that is the ugliness that the modern world will not accept.
Right. Rather than seeing the beauty of people caring for one another. That the most beautiful thing on earth is a beautiful act of one human being taking care of another human being. And
amen.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is a very superficial view of beauty if you think we have to remove suffering from our lives. Anyway, you're right. That's a real sign of our poverty right there.
Yeah.
A counterexample, though, to this gloomy walls of retirement homes. The Little Sisters of the Poor around the world, when I'm speaking, especially here in San Francisco, you walk into their home for the aged, the elderly, and they made it like you're walking in a little town. I mean, it's a big, tall atrium, and there's a barber shop, and there's a, you know, and there's a little grocery store. I mean, it's like you're living in a town, and the sisters are there with the people. They bring in others, families come and visit. I mean, they really take care of the elderly in a beautiful way. And on that same counterexample schema, you've got Mother Teresa of Calcutta, Saint Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and her homes for the aged, especially in India. They give them a dignified death. But ideally, the family is where the old people should be, you know?
Ideally. So since there's so little in this chapter, we can jump to 254, the very last line. You know, so much of what he says is so negative and so critical, and I guess we have to hear it. This is the medicine we need. But when he says something like this, this is inspiring. Love for God and for others and the patient, stubborn search for the good are more than ever the kinds of dissidents the world needs. Right. You know, you want to tell young people, you want to be truly revolutionary? You don't want to be truly radical? Then love someone who's hard to love. And you will be doing something radical.
Yep. Amen.
So, Joseph, your study questions, which people, of course, have been very carefully reviewing and preparing before each session, do they go up to chapter 13?
They do.
All right. The decline of courage and the fatal utopias of the, quote, best of all worlds, unquote. Anything there? Well, you have a lot of marks in your book.
Well, he has this whole profile of courage, you know, what is it, you know, and it's very edifying, you know, strength of character and firm determination of men when faced with difficult situations, the enemy of fear, and I don't know, don't you just want to rise up and, yeah, rise up and do something great? No, really, it's really great. And then he segues to what young people, in a certain way, he's saying young people are made to live courageously and live nobly. And they're searching for this, right?
Yeah.
He's talking about young people searching for this. They aspire to heroism and to noble conduct and to an intensely spiritual life. That's the top of 256.
Yeah, because do it now, you young people, because when you get old, you stop getting that motivation.
So we're really shortchanging young people when we kind of coddle them and don't call them forth to greatness.
Yeah, and again, page 260, unless someone wants to trump me, same thing, not being radical. What is it to be really radical? Well, on page 260, I kind of somehow quotes one of my favorite passages from the gospel. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. He cannot serve God and mammon. And then his comment after that: money is thought to liberate us from slavery and poverty. Nevertheless, although we are unwilling to admit it, we are prisoners of the chains of materialism. The golden calf is incapable of leading us toward the promised land. From then on, it sells us to other vulgar, vain gods: hedonism, egotism, and consumerism. That's radical in the best Christian sense of the word.
You know, it might seem kind of counterintuitive the way on the page before this, he's talking about the necessity of gratuitousness, the necessity of generosity, the necessity that in order to have a feast, you have to have something unnecessary. And many people would assume, I think, well, in order to have gratuitousness, in order to have generosity, we have to have wealth, right? Don't those things go hand in hand? And there is this strange irony that actually, no, the more wealthy and comfortable people become, there's a tendency actually toward more and more selfishness. And some of the most generous people you will see are, you know, the poor, who what little they have, they open their door and share it with the person next door or whatever. Mother Teresa would always tell stories like this about the people in India, you know, some poor person giving what little they have to the other poor person, right? So we kind of assume, oh, you need to have wealth to have generosity. That's not what the cardinal's talking about. Yeah. He's talking about...
I agree with you completely. That the one thing we do need to be very sensitive towards in terms of language is that we do tend in our materialistic culture to see wealth and money as being synonymous. And of course, wealth can come in all sorts of different forms. You know, the saint is the wealthiest person in the world because the saint is full of grace, right? And that's the most important wealth. That wealth which is connected to health. So we need to sort of, again, differentiate between what is genuine wealth. Is it the number of things you possess, especially if they possess you? How wealthy are you, right? So these sort of radical questions, I think, we should be asking ourselves. And Cardinal Sarah, God bless him, they're the questions he's asking.
Yes, I would love to just read this from 259. He says, I think it is urgent for us to become reacquainted with the experience of gratuitousness. It is the prerequisite for friendship, beauty, study, contemplation, and prayer. A world without gratuitousness is an inhuman world. I call on Christians to open oases of gratuitousness in the desert of triumphant profitability. So he's asking us to really dig deeper, you know, to think about, yes, what is the connection between wealth and generosity? What kind of gratuitousness is he talking about here? When on the next page, he's slamming us for the golden calf. You know what? He's talking about an inner response. And without it, there's no friendship, beauty, or contemplation. Think about that. That requires generosity. Generosity of spirit.
Yes.
Anything else on chapter 13?
I have things, but I think that nothing that perhaps, as you rightly say, we haven't discussed or touched upon in the past.
So I think we can start next session with chapter 14, which is the face of postmodern democracies and capitalism. Quite an interesting discussion there. So, if I can work this machine properly, I want to thank you all for joining us, and we will see you next week for the next section.
Thank you for joining us for the Formed Book Club, brought to you by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. For more information on how you can instantly get thousands of movies, faith-filled programs, audio presentations, and ebooks, go to formed.org. To get a copy of the book discussed on this program, Cardinal Seurat's The Day Is Now Far Spent, go to your local Catholic bookstore or online at Ignatius.com.